Welcome to the Self-Talk Radio Show.
Mind-changing radio.
What we are doing is we are rewiring our brain through our thinking, our behaviors, and eventually this is impacted by our mood, which is going to change as well.
The United States, which makes up about 5% of the world's population, used over 80% of the opioids consumed worldwide. For people dealing with chronic pain, just getting through the day can be a trial. My next guest, Dr. Trevor Campbell, author of The Language of Pain, provides practical tools for alleviating your agony. Dr. Trevor Campbell on Self-Talk Radio Show. Brought to you by
Scribe Media.
Unlocking the world's wisdom. ScribeMedia.com. Ready to write your book, but just don't have the time? Turn to Scribe Media Book Writing. Turn your knowledge into a book. Or Scribe Guided Author. Write it yourself with professional help. Learn more at ScribeMedia.com. Welcome to Self-Talk Radio Show. I'm Sarah Spencer. My next guest, if you are looking for a way to reduce your suffering that isn't focused on drugs or expensive pain management programs, my next guest is the author of The Language of Pain, providing practical tools for alleviating your agony. Welcome, Dr. Trevor Campbell, to Self-Talk Radio Show. Hi.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. Now, your story, you're a family physician, right?
Yes. Yes.
And you came originally from South Africa, and now you're based in Canada?
Yes. Victoria, British Columbia. Very close to Seattle, actually.
Nice. That's a nice part of the country.
It is beautiful, so, yes.
What took you from South Africa to British Columbia? What? Tell me about that trek.
I was born in South Africa, and I studied there. And I left in the mid-90s. I had worked in Canada before, in 1985, as a locum, you know, just standing in for physicians. And I really liked the country. And I thought, well, let's do it before, you know, one gets older. And I actually emigrated at the age of 39. And and I found myself making my way to the West Coast. You know, obviously being born on the ocean, you try and, I think one often tries to get back to the ocean, so. Here
definitely.
I am on the island.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, what started your interest? I mean, obviously, you're a physician. You see pain come through your door on a daily basis. But what was the impetus for you writing The Language of Pain? And what is The Language of Pain?
Okay. So I have to go back a little to make this make more sense. When I was newly qualified in around about 83, I joined a practice, it was quite a high-profile practice in that there were quite a few very experienced, sought-after doctors, if I can use that word, because in South Africa at that time there was a state-run side and then also the private side. And I sort of joined thinking they're never going to take me. I don't know very much, but they did. And the curious thing that happened over time, I was building up my own practice, but a lot of the people with patients with established doctors would come to me for specific things. And they were all of a counseling nature. And I had so little experience. I couldn't figure this out. And one day I said to somebody, I said, you know, your physician is here. They're not on holiday. I know they're heavily booked, but you choose to come here all the time. And there were quite a few of them. And, you know, being South Africa with people, just kind of shoot from the hip. He said, I'll tell you why, because you have got the face that tells me, that says, tell me about it. Sorry, can I say that again?
Yeah.
He looked me right in the eye and he said, because you have got the face that says, tell me about it. And, you know, this was an odd thing for me. And so basically, but I went with it. And over time, I kind of muddled through, I guess. And the physicians whose patients came to see me were very happy because they often didn't want to do counseling and they felt it wasn't really medicine. But of course, if you're a GP, you can't escape counseling. So it's always...
Yeah. I'm going to stop you right there because that is the case where there isn't any... Bedside manner is,
lost. It's just, yes. You know, here's your prescription. Have a nice day. There's nobody that's really trying to look into your head to see where is this pain really coming from. Not to demean it or diminish it by saying it's all in your head, but sometimes it's all in your head, right?
Well, you see, the truth of the matter is everything's in our head as well. And some things are more heavily influenced by our brain, our thoughts, and thoughts determining what behaviors we'll do, and behaviors having outcome on our mood and so forth. So I became very involved with that, and I became very aware. I ended up defaulting into a type of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is widely used in medicine, and I started educating myself. Notice I started after doing it, educating myself, because at med school there isn't a lot of time devoted to that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I realized how situations impact illness. Like, you obviously, I mean, this was not an epiphany, but you just see the extent. And then in Canada, I was offered a job doing pain management in a program. And we also did opioid reductions, because the feeling was, this was already in the mid-80s, that the opioids had gone, mid-90s, that the opioids had gone too out of, or had been being used too excessively, is a better way to put it. And I saw the results in pain management program. And I very soon came to the conclusion that one of the reasons it's badly managed, I think. I mean, look, we have the injection therapists and, you know, so forth, which give much needed respite to patients. You know, if you've had a severe pain for a long time, even if you get relief for a month or two or three, it's wonderful, but not curative. And then you had the pain management program, which was out of the reach for most people unless they had insurance or something like that. And then of course, there's the physician, going to the physician or physiatrist. But the problem is, Sarah, that our current medical delivery model, or I would say, I'd stick my neck out a bit and say, almost precludes the actual proper dealing of pain management, being able to deal with it properly at patient level. It involves an enormous amount of education, a lot of repetition, because these people are distressed, their sleep's poor, often they're depressed. And so that problem is coupled with the fact that it's badly taught. Chronic pain is badly taught at med school. And I do occasionally lecture to residents, family practice residents. That's their second year. They're qualified physicians. And the teaching, in my opinion, has not progressed a great deal. So you've got this delivery model coinciding with physicians who, their studies being done, report that they have some discomfort, in fact, considerable discomfort, dealing with chronic pain because they feel they haven't been trained enough.
What kind of training are they looking for? Like, if a patient comes in and says, I'm feeling pain in my neck.
Yes.
Then are there certain questions that they're not being trained to ask?
No, it's to look at the whole picture, because at this point we have to discuss the, you know, the old model for medicine was the biomedical model, which looked at the physiology, the anatomy, the biochemistry and so forth, hormones. But in order to deal with chronic pain properly, we have a biopsychosocial model of treatment. If you cannot ignore the psychological and social factors, people's loss of role. You know, someone would come crying and say, look, I used to be the poster soccer mom and now I can't even get into a car. The pain is wrapped up with all sorts of social loss, psychological issues, poor sleep, depression, high anxiety, all sorts of anxiety states, in fact. So this is why it's not something in medical school, I think, that has traditionally had a lot of interest, because it's not even, we know it's important in chronic disease and chronic pain, but you... At med school, you're being lectured to by physicians who are very interested in what I would call hardcore medicine, and these are seen as other disciplines. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's had a back seat. When I was at med school, we were told, look, chronic pain is not acute pain, like you banging your toe, that lasts a long time. It's a different beast. There's other factors, but we weren't taught how to deal with it. There's still not a lot, because it just hasn't happened. For a long time, there were very few experts in pain. And where there's, you know, the reason for there's being no experts, there was no funding. And it's only the last couple of decades, maybe, that the funding has been significant, I would say, to my knowledge.
And that's due probably to the opioid crisis. You said at one point, you said at a statistic, the U.S., which makes up 5% of the world's population, consumes 80% of the opioids consumed worldwide. Wow.
Yes. Well, sorry.
No, go ahead. That is so unbelievable to me. Yes. But it is believable because we have an epidemic going on. And exactly. Is that why you think maybe the money is shifting because of the opioid crisis, that we're saying, okay, there has to be a different way? No. Why do you think the money shifted?
I think there was this recognition of how important this non-pharmacological treatment was. This preceded the clampdown that we're seeing from health authorities on the opioids. So there was a realization that this is important, and maybe one of the main reasons why medicine excels with dealing acute pain, acute disease such as pneumonia, you know, they identify the bacteria and you get better, trauma, surgical conditions, those categories, but we really don't do well with chronic pain and with chronic diseases. So I believe in my experience that came before the clampdown on the opioids. But when I arrived in Canada in 1995, well, and this doesn't apply, this is the whole of North America, I would imagine. I don't have experience about the Mexican situation, but I was astonished at how drug representatives actually presented their case for opioids. Because where I'd come from, you know, there's people who, a lot of it's insurance-based, they have the best insurance package, and if they want opioids, they struggle to get it. And I've dealt with a lot of physicians because that was part of my job at one time. And I found that people not from North America, predominantly British, and a lot of South Africans are here as well, they were kind of astonished as well. So it was not something that was a problem everywhere at that time. So the drug companies certainly overrepresented the benefits and underrepresented the risks, I feel, to varying degrees. And we've seen lawsuits since then, of course.
We're speaking with Dr. Trevor Campbell. He's the author of The Language of Pain. And when we come back, we're going to find out from Dr. Campbell. He says chronic pain is amplified by engaging in pain behaviors. What are those behaviors? We're going to find out when we come back on Self Talk Radio Show.
Thinking of having your own podcast? Maybe you need a business website? Go to webhelpus.com and they can set you up with a website for as low as $399 for $24.95 a month. Very affordable. In fact, they're responsible for the website for Self Talk Radio Show. Visit webhelpus.com.
Welcome back to Self Talk Radio Show. My guest, Dr. Trevor Campbell. He's the author of The Language of Pain. Now, you say chronic pain is amplified by engaging in pain behaviors. What are pain behaviors other than stubbing your toe? I don't understand. Yeah. I don't understand what that is.
Again, you see this clinically. You see what we see clinically, like working in a pain program, that's based on our experiences, empirical, if you like. And we talk about things clinically. It doesn't mean that everything is backed up by a study or adequately backed up by a study. Studies have to satisfy special conditions, criteria, and so on. But having done many, many very detailed file reviews. If you look at the history of someone who's had pain, say, for 10, 20, 5, 10, 20 and more years, it always starts firstly with a pain focus, invariably, most of the time. And so what happens is two people, let's just compare two people who have the exact same injury and they've got more or less the same, you know, physical health at the time and so forth, strength. The one will realize that, okay, I've been injured. I'll follow the instructions. When they say keep it immobile, I'll keep my shoulder immobile when I'm told to start exercising it, despite it hurting, because hurt doesn't always equal harm. That's to keep the mobility and so forth, and I'll have better functionality. And they do it, and they eventually get better. The other person will say, I've got pain, this is abnormal, I cannot use that. What they do is they then develop fear avoidance behaviors, like not moving it, not trying to move it, guarding it, pampering it, and so forth. And then we move on to things like catastrophizing, which is something we use in cognitive behavioral therapy counseling, where people magnify the symptom to a crazy degree, like the pain's so bad they're going to cut off my limb. Well, there's no evidence that pain causes people to amputate, you know, causes amputation. It's that kind of thinking that builds up on it, because what we are doing, and here I come to a very important concept called neuroplasticity, is we are rewiring our brain through our thinking, our behaviors. And eventually this is impacted by our mood, which is going to change as well. So, and when I say our behaviors, Sarah, it's very important to realize it's not just specific things that we do. It's important things that we routinely did without thinking that we've now stopped doing. So that's also behavior. Inactivity is a behavior. People don't like to think of it as that, but it's a behavioral choice. I'm going to lie on a, I'm going to just sit on a chair or a sofa today. And obviously that's not good for you. Now in the shoulder situation, the person who's guarded their shoulder, not moved it. And I like this analogy because it's more of a, less of a typical chronic pain situation, but it's an analogy for how it works. So by not moving his shoulder for a long time, eventually that shoulder becomes stiff, and we call it frozen shoulder. The technical medical name is adhesive capsulitis. And it sometimes takes 18 months to 2 years to thaw that out. For it to thaw out, I should rather say. Mm-hmm. So these two people could have had the same surgery by the same surgeon, equal, everything equal, but the one was too scared to move their arm when they were asked to, because what was a good idea in the beginning of the process, you have to be careful with the arm. Now it's healing, you can move it, and that'll promote healing. The second person chose to ignore. Now, this is one of the toughest things, and I want to bring this up here because it may, what I've just said may come across as callous to some. It's one of the most difficult things to accept, that once a patient is educated, that they feel that their situation, which may be dire, there could have been some role that they played in it by just being too afraid to move a bit more where they could, where sometimes, you know, often hurt does not equal harm. When you're getting fit for football, you know, you speak to these guys, they have sore legs, sore arms, everything, but it's part of a process. So the analogy in pain is one still has to attempt movement, you know, under supervision, and this doesn't happen. So it's the choices that determine the outcome to a large extent, I would say. I don't know if I'm making that clear enough. Is that
yeah, awesome? And now it almost sounds like, okay, so the person who's protecting her shoulder and doesn't want to move because she's afraid that she's going to hurt herself, because the neuroplasticity, her brain has been wired to expect that it's going to hurt if she moves it. And she doesn't have that expectation of it's going to get better if she moves it. Is that where you come in with the cognitive therapy? Yes. Okay. So, so then you're trying to change that, that wiring, so that instead of her expecting the pain, it's going to be, you're going to move through the pain. Is that what you're working with?
Correct. That's what we're doing. The neuroplasticity, our brains are constantly being rewired in any case. We learn a new language, our brain gets rewired. We lose a language that we spoke in childhood through not practicing. Our brain is somewhere unwired. I would say the difference between chronic pain and acute pain fundamentally, and this is very simplistic view, is that when you burn your hand on the stove, you take it off, and it's painful. You've learned your lesson. The plate was actually on, and that was a reflex. You know, going to the brain, interpreted as a threat, and we call it the flexors of your arm. The muscles that take your arm away are activated, and the ones that hold it there are inhibited, and you get over it. You recover, but the minute you have the pain becomes chronic, we know that there are changes. The actual pain moves neurologically into an area we call the prefrontal cortex. It's just near the front of your brain, and it becomes associated with emotions and memory. And that's where the problem comes. And one of the problems we saw in chronic pain programs, which can be very effective, by the way, but they are out of reach of many people, I would say most people, is that we didn't get them early enough to really do it much faster than we achieved the results, meaning it was more intractable situation. That we say in neuroscience, or it is said in neuroscience, that the neurons or nerve cells that fire together, meaning are activated, they wire together. Eventually that pattern becomes, we say, facilitated and entrenched. And this is the difficult thing to understand. For the people who don't move their hands and or whatever, and the people who do develop chronic pain, it makes sense. When something hurts, you want to move it less. So intuitively it's sense, but your brain sees that as a threat, because it's like your body shutting down. The message to the brain is, this is really serious. You don't move your arm, you don't do this, you don't do that, you've stopped doing that, and you catastrophize, you're focused. I mean, I use the analogy all the time. When you're learning to drive, they say, be careful to rubberneck at anything going on at the side of the road, because you drive where you look.
Dr. Trevor Campbell is the author of The Language of Pain, and when we come back on Self Talk Radio Show, we're going to ask him more about accepting pain. What's that all about? Can you accept pain? When we come back on Self Talk Radio Show. Need to stop bad habits, start positive change, and sleep like a baby? Check out meditations free at sleepmeditation.org.
You also talk about accepting pain. Can you talk more about that?
Yes, I think it's so basic that people, it doesn't even sound medical, like, you must accept it, but people, we don't always accept what happens to us. Now, I have worked in a compensation setting as well, with disability and so forth, which gave tremendous insights. Often people who are injured at work, for example, and it wasn't their fault, and there's a sense of unfairness. Somebody came to work under the influence and they drove a forklift truck into me or something like that, right?
Right.
They just cannot accept that. And then what happens, it's like, I can't believe this. It's like after a natural disaster, that's stunned, and nothing can happen in that stage. Or that state, I should say. So it's understandable that someone would be upset and possibly outraged, but it doesn't help the recovery. And they have to, in the book, I use the analogy of, you know, the home was destroyed by fire and I can't accept it. So I don't phone the insurance people. I don't rebuild. I don't make other arrangements. Acceptance is extremely important. Otherwise, we don't have what we like to call buy-in in chronic pain. People will not do what they cannot, what they haven't accepted. So, meaning we would get people who say, well, my insurance said I have to come here. Otherwise, if I don't try this, I don't get benefits. Whether or not that's true, they come in like somebody going to university to study for a degree they don't really want to do. You see, so there's that acceptance. I tie it up very much in the book with meaning, because what happens, because of the shortage of, or the lack in some cases of training, a lot of chronic pain people have not been given an adequate explanation of their condition. They'll say, but my cousin had an injury like this and he's fine, he's playing soccer, or she's playing racquetball. And look at me, what's going on? So they've never received an adequate explanation. So how do you buy into a plan when you don't feel you know what's going on and you cannot accept the plan? There's two kinds of acceptance. The one is the acceptance that there is an issue that needs to be addressed. And there's quite a few people who aren't there yet. The second aspect of acceptance, once they've accepted the first, is that let's come up with a plausible, doable plan that can take you forward. And that's where one has to carefully explain that this is probably the best chance for recovery. I can tell you now that every person I respect, that I know rather, in chronic pain, will say that whatever treatment they give, they cannot really realistically expect success without this component being delivered as well, or having been delivered. So it's something that's looks like kitchen table advice, and actually, to be honest, a lot of it is, but it's fundamental to recovery.
We're speaking with Dr. Trevor Campbell on Self Talk Radio Show. And when we come back, we're going to find out lifting mood by challenging thoughts and how to escape acute pain and activate your life by modifying your behavior. How to do that? Coming up next on Self Talk Radio Show. Welcome back to Self Talk Radio Show. I'm Sarah Spencer. My guest is Dr. Trevor Campbell, talking about his book, The Language of Pain. And one thing I wanted to ask you, I had Dr. Dawson Church on the show a while ago, and we talked about secondary benefits of pain. And do you ever come across patients who just live for talking about their medical condition ad nauseum?
Well, there is, there are people who have, unfortunately, I see it as a product of resignation. Many of them have tried a lot and it hasn't worked. And now it's into a default sort of situation where I call it, you know, there's a chapter, The Spiral Upwards, because they spiral down. So eventually, as the pain gets worse, and it probably does, because when your life when one's life becomes more and more sort of less rewarding, that in itself is an amplifier for pain. It's like depression. So they're not getting exercise. Importantly, they're not socializing, a lot of them, and we know that you're not getting exercise, you're unlikely to be sleeping properly. In the 90s, there were a lot of studies done on what causes happiness, or what is happiness, is it composed of, by Seligman and others, many others. It's astonishing that what makes most people happy the bulk of it is our social interactions. And the number of people in that sort of category that we're talking about that will say, well, I do get invites, but I just tell my spouse to say I'm sleeping. And then I ask, but why would you do that? You like these people. Yeah, but what fun am I? And I'm no fun, and they don't want to see. I say, well, look, you know, you're friends, and I always use the term friendship is made of sterner stuff. Why don't you try and even go to a gathering, and even if you stay a half an hour, say hello to everyone. They're obviously still concerned about you. So it's this poverty of life that goes down, and then eventually the demands become more, such as, you know, dish up my food at the family gathering, bring it to the sofa. I have seen cases like that. Now, there was a study done that showed that spouses and caregivers who were a bit less accommodating towards chronic pain patients, they actually, the patients with pain actually did better long term because they did more. So I'll give an example. Like, okay, so you've crushed your ankle, but you can still take your time and unload the dishwasher. You know, that kind of thing.
Right. The caregiver who is enabling this behavior needs to back off because they're actually making it worse on everyone.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And you know something, when I was talking to Dr. Church, he said, well, there's secondary benefit for people who have this illness, because it's like, if you hear the work of Byron Katie, who would I be without that thought? Who would I be without my pain? Yeah. Yes. Some people are lost in who would I be if I wasn't in pain all the time?
Well, yes, absolutely, Sarah. But you know, the other thing is that there is the secondary gain. But there's also this idea that pain grows as we reinforce it by our stopping certain healthy behaviors, sometimes most of the healthy behaviors, self-help and so forth, and our emotions. And these are people that are really suffering emotionally. Some of them can find it. I mean, there's all kinds of other pathology too, such as there could be even an element where, you know, you get people to do more things for you and so forth. I mean, obviously that exists in any condition. Mm-hmm. But as the pain extends in the prefrontal cortex, more involving more one's emotions, and they're very in an emotional state already, it kind of, the circuitry expands. And then it's entrenched in, it's also a part of the memory center where memory is, right? And this becomes new normal.
What would you advise someone who's listening to this right now and is dealing with acute pain? What would you advise them to do?
Do you mean acute in the sort of like severe, or do you mean acute? Okay,
so I guess I should, you know, if they're in chronic pain, let's say that it's an ongoing condition. Maybe they broke their ankle 6 months ago and they're still having challenges with pain, and they don't want to do any hard, you know, opioids or anything like that. What would you say to that person?
Well, firstly, I will assume they have gone to their physician, but it depends on the situation, the diagnosis, and so forth. But if you have been diagnosed with chronic pain, or if one has been diagnosed with chronic pain, I would say that it's good to know the following, that these non-pharmacological interventions are very helpful, and that one needs to basically have a multimodal approach that's biopsychosocial. Now, I'll explain that. So one has to find a couple of things that work, because one intervention doesn't save the day, such as physio alone, and I'm not picking on physio or chiropractic or acupuncture, usually less common for an ankle, but people often invest in one thing and that's going to be their thing, but it's got to be multimodal. Now the the biopsychosocial aspect is multimodal already, but you can combine it. Maybe they need some kind of painkiller for a short period. I don't believe that opioids are beneficial. The evidence is out. It doesn't work long term for chronic pain, and the risks where usually end up outweighing the benefits completely. But they need to get to see somebody who's maybe knowledgeable. If their doctor said, look, and you know, these days a family physician, I mean, for a long time already, can't be an expert and deliver babies and do this and do that, and necessarily know, is try and get referred to somebody who can help them with that, because the sooner they start, the more chance they've got of earlier success. And I think at that length of time, we have here in Canada tele-CBT, which is CBT, a few sessions over the phone, where the people get insights so that they're forewarned, is forearmed, and they don't fall into these pitfalls. But firstly, they've got to have the diagnosis by somebody confident to make that. It's usually at 6 months, it is chronic pain pretty much, unless you something like you crack your heel, those can take longer normally to heal. That's what I would advocate. I think the book would be helpful. I have had feedback already that from physicians who say, I know you wrote this for lay people, but because of what's out there or what's not out there, I can't see that doctors would not be very interested in this.
Yes.
Family definitely. Physicians, right? Because this is something that one can do. I wouldn't do this in a walk-in clinic so easily, but if you have a set time, you can give them homework, you can give them notes to take and so forth.
The book is The Language of Pain from Dr. Trevor Campbell. And where can we get more information on you and your book?
Well, there is a website, Trevor Campbell MD. It's really a link to the book and some thoughts. It's very early stage, so it's not it's not comprehensive at this stage. But what I'm trying to do is I am trying to look at how we can address chronic pain at the moment, but also chronic illness, which is, I mean, that's a more ambitious task. It's going to take a while and a lot of reading and a lot of help and so forth. But I mean, the point is, how can we equip the patient so that by the time they come to the physician, they kind of get a lot of what's going on? And then because, you know, why do we send people to specialists and the best in town, and yet the outcomes are not often stellar in chronic disease? In fact, they generally, it's a huge financial problem as well, because people don't really they usually need some ongoing certainly monitoring and care. So that's what I'm trying to do. I think the medical education shouldn't be confined, it cannot be confined to the consulting rooms in this particular model. There just isn't the time. I mean, I've been a physician now 38 years, right? And even with double appointments and a very compliant, motivated patient, and usually they're not very motivated because they're so tired from not sleeping properly and being depressed and anxious. So that's something I'm becoming very interested in. The power of good daily habits, armed with information and good practices, and I call it weeding the garden in my meditation chapter, weeding out these thoughts that don't help you. We shouldn't suppress them. Suppressing things often energizes them. We know this already. But we should have a rational argument where, I used to think this, but now this is not only better for me, but it actually makes more sense. That's where we want to get. And I think that we're way too pill focused.
Dr. Trevor Campbell, thank you so much for being on the show. We'll look for your book and your website. and look forward to the language of pain, learning more about that. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much, Sarah. I enjoyed it.
All right. I'm Sarah Spencer for Self Talk Radio Show.
If you'd like to learn more about our guests and their offerings, please visit our website, selftalkradioshow.com. Our broadcast is growing. We include iTunes, Google Play, Alexa, iHeartRadio, and also you can find us on Spotify and our flagship C-Suite Network with over 500,000 business professionals. If you'd like to reach them and you'd like to advertise with us, make sure you visit info@selftalkradioshow.com. We'd love to talk to you more. I'm Sarah Spencer. Thanks for listening, and please subscribe.